When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second-guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hello and welcome to season 3 of Get It Off Your Breasts, the podcast that digs into all those issues that really get under your skin. I'm Leanna Bird, and joining me with Emma Gannon, we have some very special guests.
So we are very excited to be in the lovely home of the comedian Sophie Duker.
Hey!
Thank you for the crisps.
Oh, I'm so glad that you gave me an excuse to have those crisps.
We've hoovered them up in seconds.
It's amazing in here. So as our guest, you are welcome to go first. What would you like to get off your breasts today?
What do I want to get off my breasts? So many things. But since we're in my house, in the constituency of Hackney North and Stoke Newington, I thought that what I wanted to get off my breasts today in particular was Diane Abbott. Specifically, the treatment of Diane Abbott, not Diane Abbott herself. I feel very personally connected to this issue, despite not really knowing Diane Abbott. I have met her now. I met her last year, but I didn't really know her before last year when there was the general election and there was like the amplification of all the nonsense about her. In short, Diane Abbott gets almost half of the hate mail that's sent to female MPs. Like, it's all coming to her. When I ended up meeting her last year, she told me that the thing that most surprises people who work for her, when they come to work for her, is the amount of hate mail that they have to sift through. Like, part of that every day is just going through, like, racist, sexist, like, horrible, like, messages, death threats. She gets it constantly. But everyone finds it just, like, really fun to take the piss of her. She's just like an easy target. She's always where like she gets people really like frothed up and angry, and I think it's lazy and I think it's boring, and I think we should all leave Diane Abbott alone. She's objectively a great politician. I could go on, but I feel like
no, you can't. I mean go on, because I'm just sort of intrigued as to why I think we've all noticed it, right? The treatment of Diane Abbott, and why you think it is, because there's obviously people talking about the fact that she's a woman, the fact that she's black. There's also every time she makes a mistake, which a lot of politicians do, it seems to be really overly amplified. And I just wondered why you think she gets this treatment by not just public people sending her crazy hate mail, but also press as well.
I think the reason she gets it more than other people is because I think it's a variety of reasons. I remember someone around the time of the last general election was saying that, oh, you could put a red rosette on a donkey in Hackney and it'd get elected. But that doesn't ignore the fact that she's like last year improved her majority. She's like her majority was about as big, like the amount that she was in front of the next candidate was almost as much as Theresa May's entire vote. So the amount that she increased like her majority in front of the other person was as much as Theresa May got of all of her support in her constituency. And I think the reason that I ended up having to meet her is that she kind of disappeared from her role during the election, because in a kind of unexplained way at the time, she'd like had the whole gaffe over getting numbers wrong.
That was on LBC, right?
It was on an LBC.
She was asked something about police numbers. She didn't have the numbers to hand, and so she kind of I think she sort of mumbled.
She sort of fumbled it and like stuffed
it. She basically had a bit of a panic. Instead of just going, I don't have the numbers, she kind of just tried to sort of not answer it, and it just became a bit of a viral thing, didn't it? And everyone liked to mock her basically for the back of that.
But like so many, even just I was looking back at articles from that time, and even like just around that time, there were like five, like Jeremy Hunt couldn't remember the minimum wage. There were other MPs that couldn't remember like huge numbers of like really of things that are kind of constants.
Didn't Philip Hammond get like 20 billion wrong off the economy and no one cared? No one said anything?
No one cared because it's not as, it's sort of just not as fun to be like, oh, she's terrible in interview, and people are like, I'm not voting for Labour because like Diane Abbott's an idiot. Like, it's just, she wouldn't be in cabinet anyway. The reason I think that Diane Abbott gets it more than everyone else is for loads of reasons, but partly because she's been there so long. She was first elected to the same seat that she's in now, Hackney North and Stoke Newington, in 1987. And in the environment of her getting into politics in the late 80s, it's obviously a lot harder than it is now for younger MPs to be a black woman in that space, to be fighting against, firstly, being a young MP. Like, everyone knows that, like, Mari Black goes viral because she says great things, like, in the House of Commons. But to be a young person in that environment, which is overwhelmingly full of really, really conservative, whether with a big C or a little C, old white men, to not be trusted, and also to be the only person that looks like you that isn't cleaning stuff up, must have been really hard. And I think that takes a certain amount of grit and determination. And I wasn't even alive when she got elected. But I think for me, other than obviously people are sexist and people are racist, I think the fact that she has persisted and she's like old now, the fact that she's like an auntie, the fact that she's not perfect anymore, she's not this young, like, go-getter first female black MP anymore, means that people just want to tear her down. I think there's a special pressure on women and on women of colour in certain scenarios to be perfect, to be this superwoman. And because she's revealed that she can be old and can be slow after fighting for like 30 years, people will jump on any sign of weakness. You're not allowed to be there unless you're being the very best. And I think that's a particularly unfair thing about Diane Abbott.
Yeah, totally. And I think that when I look at her, I just think of her resilience over the years, because like you said, maybe the reason why she's still going, because I think a lot of people are actually shocked that she is still going and that she is still getting up in the morning and doing this job, because I think most people probably would think they couldn't. And I wonder if it's part of that, that actually she's used to it, which is even sadder. No one should be used to that treatment.
Yeah, I think she's absolutely, like, it's just become part of daily life almost. It is part of daily life. It's the emails come in every day, people just say, like, I think, like, from doing comedy writing and stuff, people do make, like when there's open source shows where they get like contributions to the public, she's an easy target. It's like making a fat joke, people will make a joke about Diane Abbott.
That feels so sad though, because, but you know, when you mentioned Diane Abbott and when you said that you were talking about it today, the first things that pop into your mind, like, are often, you know, the mistake you talked about that she made on LBC about the figures through of police officers, or something else that she said that people jumped on. And actually, you know, she was the first black female MP. That is huge. Like, that should be the first thing that pops into our minds. And to be becoming a figure, I don't know, I just think that's something really, really wrong about that. Like, she's opened up the door to so many other people and has taken steps, and like, was a leading the path where no one else would have gone.
But I think that's the difference between people that respect her and people that don't, because I actually got into a massive argument with someone about Diane Abbott once. They were being so disrespectful about her, saying that they'd, you know, heard this story about how she talks to herself, and that she was in the back of a taxi and she was just like, that she basically making out that she was like mental, which isn't very PC or very respectful.
But it's the classic, like, crazy old, like, bag lady.
And people treat her like this dithery old woman, which I hate. I hate when people are quite ageist like that. But my point was, like, you know, we should respect her. You're treating her really badly. You're joining in with this horrible troll behaviour. And their response, and by the way, this is someone I don't know. I just met them and I overheard them say it at like a networking thing. They were like, just because she's a woman and just because she's the first of something doesn't mean I should respect her. And we had a massive argument.
No, but I think it's what you were saying about, it's the disproportional attention she gets when she makes a mistake. So it's like people are waiting to jump on. So it's like, because she's a little bit older, because she's female, like, people are going, oh, look, she doesn't know what she's talking about. She's an idiot. She's losing it. She's not good at her job. Whereas other people, like we talked about Philip Hammond making huge errors about, you know, he accidentally missed 20 billion off the economy, small thing. No one seems to bother, because it's like, oh, well, he's a, you know, a white middle class conservative male. He couldn't possibly be, you know.
Yeah,
it's that stereotype of kind of dithery old lady, isn't it? Yeah. And she's not that old, is she?
She's not. I mean, I don't know how old she is. I could confirm.
I don't feel she's that old. I mean, not. Yeah, I don't know. It feels like you said lazy.
It is really lazy, and I think other people are allowed to just fail upwards to keep being crap in roles, like with like the, he's not still Brexit Secretary, but Dominic Raab just being like, oh, I've realised that there's like a Dover Calais crossing. Like, I didn't really realise that would be significant in Brexit. Like Boris Johnson making a career out of being like a sort of gaffe-making old uncle.
Yes. And oh my god,
everyone finds it kind of almost endearing and charming.
If Diane Abbott came to like the House of Commons like not dressed properly or with her hair all messed up or spouting things that later turned out to not be true or hideously offensive, she wouldn't have her seat, even though I said she's no longer that superwoman figure. Just being her and not, I think not having a complete breakdown is kind of being a superwoman, getting on with it every day.
Do you feel that's almost though? Do you feel that kind of can be transferred to all different realms of life? Like as a woman, I, for example, feel really nervous when people, especially men on the street, watch me park because I don't want to live up to that stereotype. But when I'm on my own, I can park really well-ish. But it's that kind of thing of like everyone, it will confirm a sort of already negative stereotype.
Yeah.
Do you think that especially for women of colour is the case? Like that you almost have to, like, present yourself more kind of competently across all different realms because there are people looking to sort of trip
you up? Yeah, I think you can see it with a lot of women of colour, like Meghan Markle, who is, like, she's been an actress, she's now a member of the royal family, she's someone who perfection is demanded of, and people will pick up on the fact that she holds her bump too much, or that she wears the wrong color tights, or that she seems fake. Like, she's literally an actress, like, it's her job to be nice to everyone. And I think it's a special, I think people are just waiting for her to slip up.
It feels like bullying.
Yeah,
actually.
Yeah, I mean, it is bullying. Yeah. It's just people can't believe that they're in the positions that they're in. They can't believe their success, and so they want there to be something wrong with them.
Mm-hmm. And I think like we're right, like all politicians and people in the public eye, like, of course, you know, in response to what your friend was saying, Emma, like, should be held under scrutiny. Like, no one's above scrutiny, right? We all welcome that, and I'm sure like Diane Abbott welcomes that, but it's only when it's proportional and fair that it's, and it does seem like every little thing she's doing is being blown up. But you did something really lovely for her, didn't you?
It was when she, due to like this unexplained reason due to illness, kind of backed out of the general election and kind of retired from being an MP quite briefly. And I was working in an office where lots of people had kind of political opinions, and people were saying the same things about her being terrible all the time. And I just, like, my heart kind of broke for her, just like feeling like she's being demonized, like on every channel, people making jokes about her. Like, if Labour doesn't win the election, it's not really to do with Jeremy Corbyn. She's just taking the brunt of everything that's wrong with the party. And so I was like, maybe she's, I don't know what's happened to her. Maybe she can't like leave the house. Maybe she feels shit. We're going to send her a care package and we're going to put in like loads of balms and things to like soothe her and make her feel good. And I also made like a Beyonce gif and like photoshopped Diane Abbott's face onto it, the one where she's in the formation video and she's like putting two middle fingers up.
What was the Serena Williams? Did you ever get that?
No, yeah, we put everything in the, so I made a list of the stuff that we were going to put in, and it was stuff like, there was a copy of Chewing Gum by Michaela Cole, Check Chewing Gum Dreams, the original screenplay. We got her loads of coconut oil because coconut oil.
I love that.
Is a bomb.
Did she get the package?
Yeah, we actually hand delivered her the package in the end. There was also like loads of fried plantain, which is the thing that she was most interested in, which I was really surprised that she even ate. I was like, you don't know who we are. We're just coming up to rocking up to Westminster.
Did she reach out or anything?
So I think, yeah, her office reached out and was like, oh, because I was like, if we raise any extra money than what it costs to get her this care package, we'll donate it to Hackney charities. So I thought we'd get like £100 and we made £6,000 for Hackney charities.
Wow.
amazing.
And that just goes to show as well, like, how much support there is out there.
Yeah, and she's so loved. Like, looking back at the messages, people are just... They love her so much. People are like, whether they're like working class, whether they're young black girls, or just people who notice what she's doing. And I think it's so rare as an MP that you get to see a big demonstration of love for you. Like, obviously you can help people on a one-on-one basis and you can do work with individual charities, but I think a lot of people decided that she was an inspiration. And in response to what you said, it's not because she's the first or because she's a woman, it's because of what that took to get there, what her being there proves. And it's like, it's not an accident. You don't get to be in that position.
You don't continue to do it for that long by accident either. I wonder if, you know, in response to that question of like, I wonder how she still does it, maybe that's exactly why, is she gets those messages from these young women, and you could get one message like that and be like, right, this is why I'm doing it. It's really important to tell people, I think, what they mean to you.
Emma, what have you got to get off your breast today?
So my topic today is something that probably every woman listening would probably relate to in some way. I was in a pub recently and it was really busy, and we were watching something on TV, some sport or something. Anyway, there was a break, went to the loo. I was queuing for the loo for like 35 minutes.
Whoa.
And it was just, there was no toilets in there. There was like maybe two. And I just noticed the men just go in and out and in and out and in and out. And like literally 50 people had gone in and out by the time, you know, we were just standing there. And I was just thinking, that is so much time that women spend just waiting. And this was based on, this topic that I wanted to talk about was sort of based on an article I read on The Atlantic. They've done this really intellectual essay about this thing, which they call potty parity. So like, how do we become equal when it comes to like going to the toilet? But I think it is a bigger issue. And I think actually, why haven't we solved this? Like, why haven't people built just more toilets for women? So this is two part, because that annoys me. But the other thing that annoys me is, why do we as women spend more time faffing around in toilets? Because we're not always on our period, but maybe socially we're like checking in the mirror, you know, worried about something or just taking our time in there. And is that socially, like, have we been socially conditioned to basically waste time on our appearance constantly?
Isn't there, like, physiologically though, like, women just do take longer to wee? Because we have to. Why?
But I don't know. I go in, I wee, and I get out. Sometimes I don't quite understand.
I'm quite shocked how long some women take. Go on, Sophie.
Yeah, well, okay,
be brave.
So I'm not a scientist. I'm not one of those science guys. I don't know. About
Disclaimer: none of us are scientists.
None of us are scientists. I don't know about the actual science of it. When I was doing Riot Girls, the program on Channel 4 that I did, that was kind of, in a funny way, like getting women's issues to the fore, we did stuff on this, because there's always a queue for the women's toilets. One reason it happens is that people just didn't really think women would go out and be social. So a lot of old buildings, we did a sketch that wasn't aired at the Royal Opera House, don't have toilets for women. They weren't toilets for women. So they're much smaller, or they don't exist, or they're converted spaces because only men, or more men, were going out and being social. I just don't think there should be gender split toilets anyway. I think everyone should have a private cubicle, which obviously isn't feasible in old buildings.
I was in some shared gender toilets. What's the word?
Unisex.
Unisex.
Or just toilets.
just toilets.
I was in some toilets, and they were, unisex, and this guy walked in, and I'm like, I'm putting my lipstick on in the mirror, and he like freaks out. He's like, I'm so sorry, am I in the wrong place? And I was like, no, you like, take your pick, there are the loos. And he just couldn't cope with like being in that space with me. It was really weird. Like, people need to get over it.
But I think some men are quite used to women like viewing them suspiciously in a way. Like, I know some men who are actually quite thoughtful about it, and like, if they're walking down the street, for example, there's a woman, like, they will hold back because they don't want to, they are aware that women can feel threatened in certain situations. So maybe that guy was just a bit like, oh, is this woman gonna think that I'm like encroaching on her space? And
he was more nervous than he thought I would be nervous, maybe. Or
yeah,
I mean, I really wasn't. But
I think if you don't have like individual toilets, then there should be a space for people that don't want to come into contact with men. But
I mean, this is a whole other kettle of fish, isn't it? Yeah. With the news around trans rights in toilets and the changing of signs and what they mean. I mean, that is a whole other dark path of conversation,
which I don't think is trans.
I personally don't think it's that big a debate.
Well, I think in a way we should just split toilets into people who wee on the seats and people who don't wee on the seats. And anyone who doesn't wee on the seats is welcome to share the toilets. And people who wee on the seats have to use the smelly wee toilets. And all you could do, even like people who are really quick at going and just in and out, whiz and go, and those of you who want to like sit on the loo and have a little think and spend some time, you can go in the slow toilet.
That's a really good idea. It's like the escalator when you're walking and just standing, like get in your lane.
I do
like to have a sit and a think sometimes. I do enjoy also, that.
So basically it's all your fault, Sophie. These cues to the loo are all Sophie's fault.
I feel like I've been really harsh in the second bit of that one where I was like, what are people doing there? I actually think I shouldn't have said that because I'm someone who is introverted by nature, even though my job is very like out there. And then sometimes the only time when I'm freaking out and I'm feeling really anxious and socially there, I'll go and sit on the loo. The loo seat.
Yeah, no, I have that. I do that at work quite a lot. You're just like, oh, it's all too much. But I think it's like, where are you spending the time? Are you spending it in front of the mirror, or are you spending it on the seat, just being alone with your thoughts?
I'm just like sitting in the loo, like, oh my God, I'm on my own. Yes, my happy place.
And then people start bashing on the door. Can I ask if anyone else has done this? Has anyone else gone for a little nap in the loo before? A hangover.
Our producer Shola is saying yes.
I've done that many times.
I thought you were going to say a wank.
No. See, I used to do cheeky work naps, and also at school. And I would get, when I was like either really tired or hungover, I'd get the loo roll. And if you prop the loo roll on the wall next to your head, it makes a very handy pillow. Top tip, life hack.
That is such a good hack.
Don't people do that in Japan or something, you know, when the work culture is mental and they go and sleep anywhere, under the desk, 10 minutes, because their work days are so long.
Yeah. I don't blame anyone for a loo nap, but I think probably not everyone in there is napping. It's probably more, like you said, having just a little moments themselves,
a little scroll on Instagram.
But I do think, yeah, you could maybe, if there's a big old queue, you maybe wouldn't take that moment if you could see there was a lot of women actually like gagging to go. But I think also the thing about men's losers is they can wee standing upright and they can go to the urinals, so they don't all use a cubicle, so you could have like a kind of trough and they just go in and trough it up and go. They're out in 30 seconds, they don't wash their hands. I'm not saying all of them, but you know, that is kind of, yeah, we like to take a little moment more.
Also, do you think maybe new mums use that time? Because I once heard someone say a 10-minute scroll on Instagram on the loo is like a trip to the Bahamas.
Oh.
Like, as in, because they're so inundated with, like, their kids constantly. They're like, I'm going to go and sit on the loo.
I thought you were going to say a new mum like just physically takes longer to wee, which I can verify.
I just meant
it's 100% true. Right, I'm going to just lay it out here. I'm like renowned amongst my friends, guys, just showing off it, being a very fast weeer. They used to call me like, they'd be like racehorse weeing, right? I actually like thought I had a problem for a while, because I was like, I'm so quick. And people in loos often like commend me and thank me. I'm like, oh, you're so quick. So it's like my skill, my party trick, quick weeing. But when you have a baby, it does become a lot longer. It gets, you know, things go back to normal after a while, but you know, your pelvic floor muscles are basically screwed. And so people taking longer than loos, if they have had a baby relatively recently, it could be also because wees take longer.
Yeah, there's so many reasons why people probably spend ages, isn't there?
Yeah.
I take it back.
But we just need more. No, but it's like you said, we just need more of them, right?
Yeah, more of them. And so in the article, just to conclude, the final paragraph of this article is basically saying, why haven't we cracked it? I hate this phrase of like, it's 2019, because it doesn't mean anything. But we've got to this stage now in life where this is obviously a problem. We're losing minutes, precious time of our lives queuing. There is a solution. Just build more toilets.
When you're ready to pop the question, the last thing you want to do is second guess the ring. At BlueNile.com, you can design a one-of-a-kind ring with the ease and convenience of shopping online. Choose your diamond and setting. When you find the one, you'll get it delivered right to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off your purchase. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Okay, so mine's a bit heavier, right? But this is just off the back that recently there's been kind of resurgence of interest in Ted Bundy and the murders that took place, what was it, in the 70s, I think now? Murdered at least 30 women, and this year I think marks the 30th anniversary of his death. So there's been a lot of documentaries. There's also a new film, a Zac Efron film. I can't remember the name of it. Something like Viciously Evil and something. I don't know. There's a big Zac Efron mm-hmm. film coming out. And I kind of feel like the way people talk about it, and I suppose this can become a bigger sort of true crime genre issue anyway, but the way people talk about it, it's like I'm binging on Netflix on the Ted Bundy documentary, or like, oh, I can't wait to see Zac Efron as Ted Bundy. And I don't know, I just sort of feel, it feels uncomfortable to me a little bit because, well, not even just a little bit, just feels uncomfortable because a lot of those victims, well, firstly, they're real victims. It really happened. And a lot of those victims' families are still alive. Were they consulted over this big Hollywood movie and people, you know, probably a red carpet premiere and Zac Efron playing, you know, the hot serial killer? How do they feel about it, having that all dredged up? And I just sort of wonder, at what point is it okay that we get our entertainment out of other people's suffering, and why is it that we find it? And I haven't watched the Ted Bundy stuff yet, but I've listened to the Serial podcast. You know, I, you know, love that. And I'd walk around the Heath and listen to it, and you know, ooh, can't wait for the next episode. And that is off the back of someone's murder as well. So what is it about us as humans that likes it? And is there a line that we cross where we sort of are disrespecting the victims and their families? That's kind of.
But I mean, the very fact that it's 30 years on celebrating Ted Bundy, like, why aren't we mourning or celebrating or like putting some respect on the victims and not, you know, and like thinking about them, reflecting on them rather than like celebrating his death? Like, that's weird.
There was a tweet actually that I just saw before, and this guy, I wish I could remember his name, but anyway, it went viral, and he tweeted saying, with everyone talking about Ted Bundy, can we all just remember the victims? And he one by one posted photos of all the young women who were murdered by Ted Bundy that we know about, and said something about quite a lot about them, like a paragraph about them, and kind of went through them one by one. And I was like, yeah, that is, you're right, that is what we should be doing, talking about them and not him. Because I also think Ted Bundy, from what I've read or heard about him, is someone who really craved that kind of celebrity and would quite love all this attention. And
yeah, I think I've got another theory about it. I think it's quite telling, because I don't know an awful lot about Ted Bundy, but am I correct that most of the victims that we know about were women?
Mm-hmm.
And I think that it's the same thing has happened with another Netflix sensation of recent times, with You, which was a fictionalized account of basically a stalker who then turns into a serial killer because he's so obsessed with this woman. Women's suffering is seen as entertainment. People like to watch women suffer. It's like part of how we're like socialized to see seduction is slightly violent as well. And then watching women's pain on screen like becomes high art. Like, women like watching it, men like watching it. Like, if an actress can portray her pain viscerally, that's the most affecting thing. That's the most affecting thing you can see. And I think that's why people are like, oh, Ted Bundy's so sexy, because if he was going around killing, as obviously some serial killers do, if he was going around killing children or killing young boys, no one would be like, oh, have you heard, like, this, like, Orlando Bloom's playing this hot serial killer that like murdered loads of men. It's because it's women that are being killed, and so that's part of this.
So is it okay for us to watch those kinds of shows and to even be entertained by them and to enjoy them? Is that all right if it's like,
you know, it's interesting,
said,
because with You, I binged on that. And actually, the author of the book, Caroline, is a good friend of mine. And she wrote the books and then got the Netflix green light years ago. And she's like, so happy it's out. And I love that show. And I wonder if, because I was saying to my boyfriend the other night how grossed out I am about the Ted Bundy coverage. And he said, yeah, but you've watched You and you're tweeting about how much you love You. It's exactly the same. And then I thought, sorry, is it because it's fiction that I don't have a problem with it as much? Or,
but do you think that, I can't remember his name, but Dan Joe. From Gossip Girl, Penn Badgley, Joe.
Oh, Penn Badgley,
do you think,
yeah,
are you like, oh my God, Joe's so dreamy, he's so hot? Yes.
Well, it's funny because I interviewed her once just like when the books first came out. And she was like, yeah, I love Joe. Don't we all? Like, she thinks that he's... It's weird. But he's a fictional character. And I wonder if that matters or if it doesn't.
I feel like it definitely matters. But I think there's sort of different... It's like, how comfortable are we with the fact that, as you said, Sophie, we all somehow, in a gorish, weird way, feel this kind of entertainment and titillation at these kind of violence towards women, mm-hmm, and these violent murders, whether fictionalized or not. And that's a kind of almost moral, ethical, like, what's wrong with us? What's wrong with society? Why are we here? That's a kind of bigger question. But I think when it's not fictionalized, there also becomes this really other important point, like probably the most important point, which is these victims were real people, yeah, and their families are still, yeah, alive today. And I remember reading... I don't even know why I was reading this, but I was researching something and I ended up reading... the parole statement of one of Sharon Tate's family. I think it was a niece. Sharon Tate was one of the people murdered by Charles Manson. And it was, they were trying to stop one of the murderers, one of the Manson group being released. And they had to give a statement, which they, as they do regularly, have to give these statements. One of the things they brought up in it, which was just, I hadn't really thought about before, was like how painful it is for their kids. So these are like the nieces and nephews. So this is like their auntie, who was much beloved, young woman, she was pregnant, you know, horrific, awful murder. And they go to like rock concerts and someone will be wearing like a Charles Manson t-shirt, or the band will be wearing like a badge with like Manson on it. And like, it's kind of cool to talk about Charles Manson, or to read a book about the Charles Manson murders. It's like, you know, it's the 60s, it's rock and roll, it's, you know, it was an era, it's kind of rebellious, and it's got this kind of air. And like, how painful those kids found it to be around their peers who were almost celebrating that person. Or,
yeah, God.
And I just think, like, we need to think about that. And like, were Ted Bundy's victims contacted, and the victims' families, yeah, rather, contacted and asked how they feel about, think, a movie?
Oh, probably not. Capitalism is grim. Put it on a t-shirt. Woo! Yeah. I wanted to just read out this tweet really quickly because it made me think about the commissioning process as well, of getting things commissioned. So Deborah Frances White, who is a comedian, said, film studios, the problem with this female character in your screenplay is that she's dating two men, so she's really unlikable, and we've decided to pass. Also, film studios, who's the cheekiest chipmunk we can find to play Ted Bundy? It's almost like, for years we've been told unlikable women shouldn't be cast and things, and it's like, but you always cast the most unlikable men.
Yeah, yeah.
I don't get it.
I think that's really interesting, because I was talking to someone about Killing Eve. Have you guys watched it?
Oh, yeah.
And a man was saying that he didn't like it because he thought it was weird how we were glorifying the violence of it, because there's a female assassin in Killing Eve, if you haven't seen it, and she kills a lot of people. And you see quite graphically the deaths, which she doesn't really seem to be affected by. But I don't want to say that this man was affected by it because it's a woman killing people. But it's so commonplace that there are men like Bond or any other man in any other fictionalized thing that kills someone, and we don't be like, but he's not, but look how cheap life is in this thing.
Yeah. I think what Phoebe Waller-Bridges wrote Killing Eve, though, is that firstly she twisted a stereotype. So I'm not saying there's no female assassins out there, but making the kind of greatest, best, most slick assassin a female. And obviously the way it was written as well, though, it was kind of, she had some sort of amusing elements about her as well, so it wasn't like a totally serious drama. But I think the characters that she killed as well were all really distasteful characters who were kind of in that world. So it wasn't like when we watched something about Ted Bundy, or, you know,
They weren't innocent, like, sort of innocent
young virgin girls who are, you know, in their prime. They maybe have sex, and it's a classic horror movie, isn't it? Virgin girl has sex, and then 2 minutes later is murdered. Don't have sex, girls.
Do you know what else I hate as well, is that women are always portrayed in these films as like loving murderers, like you're saying about the Charles Manson badges and t-shirts. there are so many films where women are writing to murderers in jail being like, I love you, pen pals. Mm-hmm. And yes, that has happened. People would fall in love with serial killers. It's like, there's loads of books on it. But don't tar all women with the same brush as being like obsessed with a like sexy serial killer. Like, we're not all like that.
Yeah.
I read a really interesting article in The Vulture, I think it was. I'm sorry, whoever the author is, I can't remember who they are. But it was saying basically like the reason that people find it okay to watch films or documentaries, even about real life serial killers or fictional serial killers, is because the whole idea of a serial killer feels so removed from us. So we feel like we can be like safe voyeurs, whereas actually there are estimated to be around I don't know who made up this estimate, but estimated to be around 2,000 serial killers today in America. So it continues to be a threat, but it feels like something that could have happened in the 1970s or the 80s, and people were dressed differently and they looked differently, and it's not really art. We're not going to get killed by serial killers. Whereas today's serial killers really are people who shoot schools, for example, and bring out a gun. It's like, you know, angry young white boys who come in to massacre their school friends. So you wouldn't make a sort of Hollywood film about that yet, because that's not okay, but it seems okay to do it about
And it's also like the coverage of these killers when it's like a young white man, they're like, oh, a lone wolf just like straying away from his friends. Like, we all know that there's a stereotype there.
I find the phrase lone wolf infuriating because it's so cool. Like, everyone wants to be a lone wolf. It's like, stop calling people lone wolves. Yeah,
it's like, why don't you use the word terrorist like you do on everyone else? Like, why are you picking words to like describe different people?
So this is like a whole other topic, but I do think, like, when people use the word terrorism, it does have to be because whoever's doing it has a political aim. And it could be that their political aim, they are a white person with a political aim, but they have to be doing it to try and change policy somehow, irrelevant of their religion or colour. So I do think sometimes that has to be remembered. And like, whether you're brown or
definition,
black or white or yellow, whatever colour you are, if you're doing it because you are like someone who just hates society or is just mentally unwell, then that is not terrorism. But if you're doing it no matter what you look like, if you're doing it because you're trying to, because you've got like right-wing agenda and you're trying to like change the policy of the government, then that's terrorism. But that there is a distinction there.
But it's like, you know, the guy that killed Joe Cox.
Yeah, that's terrorism.
Was he called a terrorist?
Well, I think
he should have been.
I'm not sure if he was called a terrorist, but I think he definitely qualifies as a terrorist.
100%.
Yeah. As was the guy who ran down the people outside a mosque. There was a and he killed one.
But it's so infuriating the way that people in the media choose the headlines, because they will say lone wolf for those. It's awful.
Yeah.
Anyway, tangent, sorry.
No, it's a good tangent, but yeah. I
have a question also about Ted Bundy, to fill me in on my serial killer lack of knowledge. I have in a writer's room at the moment where it's a lot of men, and they are all obsessed with serial killers. We talk about serial killers like 5 times a day, and making a topical comedy show. Men love serial killers, or at least some men do. But my question about Ted Bundy is, was he actually hot?
So I think he
I feel bad saying it, because I've just spouted about how it's so awful that we're saying that.
So if you look at a photo of him,
I don't think
he's hot at all. But if you look at a photo of him, he is like more like traditionally good looking than what you would imagine like your average kind of, you know, serial killer to look like, whatever that would be. However, people who met him said that actually he was quite gross. Like, he was always picking his nose and like, not necessarily made it gross, but like, he wasn't like, didn't come across as an attractive person in real life. He was always biting his nails, and he wasn't like charming and attractive in his personality. So when you met him, he didn't seem attractive, but I think from photos,
these like black and white smoldering photos are everywhere,
and
it looks
like an Instagram filter. But anyway, like, because it's the past.
Jeffrey Dahmer was the other one, wasn't he? Everyone said that Jeffrey Dahmer was hot, but which kind of should be irrelevant. But again, Charles Manson then comes up again. It does seem to make a difference in terms of how we want to, how many people want to watch them on TV and talk about them. But
it's, oh god, I just, the amount of money that people are going to be making off the back of all these films, it just feels a bit wrong.
And I feel like they sensationalize the films and the documentaries to show more suffering of the victims, because the more kind of like dramatic they are, the higher the ratings.
Mm-hmm. And also, doesn't it show that we just value looks above everything else still? Because that's the biggest selling point. Serial killer who's also hot. Yeah. Like, do you remember that hot felon? That hot mugshot guy.
Yeah,
like, it's like, being hot is enough, apparently.
And
that is not the message
we need.
He's
now marrying, like, Philip Green's daughter or something. He's like
a baby daddy.
Oh, my God. I don't think, for the record, I don't think Jeffrey Dahmer or Ted Bundy are hot. I think they look like ordinary men. I think that knowing that they've killed people makes them have this like pattern of being sexy and dangerous. I think they could be someone's type, but they're not.
Why is killing
models.
Someone sexy? That's so. It's so. I mean, it's so
it's
odd.
Like
how have
boy.
We got this point?
It's
why
like the motorcycle leather jacket murder. Yeah.
Is it just because it's
stereotype?
The worst thing you can do. It's like the most taboo, anti-society thing you could do. Is to
but I don't think it is. I think a lot of, I mean, I'm always trying to be like, don't get super political. I think a lot of like killing is like super endorsed by our society. Like people, firstly, you don't have to be, it's like entirely your choice whether you're like for the army or anti-army, but that's still by a lot of people seen as an incredible thing to defend your country and to fight for your country, to fight like abroad, like these wars that are basically all about trade. People like sign off decisions in politics that effectively kill people who can't have access to like medication. There's an awful lot of violence that is normalized, and whether it's something like I want a guy that'll punch a guy in the face for me at a pub if someone tries to touch my bum,
which is the most unattractive thing in the world, I think, don't you think? I just find that horrible.
I have a lot of friends that's like number two on the list.
What, that they'd
punch
physically
someone if they don't protect
them?
What,
number two, that they want or that they hate?
That they want.
Really?
I had an argument with them because I was like, I don't think that's very feminist. And they were like, well, I am a feminist. And I was like, oh, God.
It's also really violent, though. What, you want someone to smash someone's face in, like, physically hurt
them? Yeah, because she was saying she wants men to feel threatened, like she feels threatened when they, like, touch her bum.
Why would you want anyone to feel threatened? Like, I just want people to feel good and happy and loved.
I kind of get it. My boyfriend was in a physical fight with someone who just decided to attack him because I think he didn't like the look of us walking down the street. And they had like a sort of scuffle. He hit him in the face and like knocked one of his teeth out. But my boyfriend's very not violent. But I think he had this sort of pride in having done it
and
having
protected you, maybe?
And having like protected you and like defended himself and like being a man and that violent. And
see,
I was like, I'm
like,
not going to congratulate you.
Yeah, but when you say it like, you know, someone in self-defense protects you, that feels like, you know, chivalrous. But when you say like, I want someone to punch someone in the face if they feel threatened, it feels really violent. And thank you so much, Sophie.
Thank you so much.
Chat and for the crisps. Thank you so much for listening to yet another juicy episode of Get It Off Your Breasts. Don't forget to click to subscribe to make sure you don't miss any further episodes.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.